Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. I want to welcome my good friend Vito in the chat room this morning. So glad that he is alongside and here in the chat room and just hanging out with me on this Thursday morning. How are you today? I hope your week has been going very well. Lots of rain here. It seems like the temperatures are turning cooler. We've been bouncing back and forth between summer and fall. It makes everyone so sick, but so glad to be here today. Well, what did you think of the debate last night? The final installment in the head-to-head boxing match between Clinton and Trump. Well, I got to see part of it. I was at work, and I was very impressed with how Donald makes the case why Hillary is not possibly even remotely fit to be president. And he went with her toe-to-toe and head-to-head in almost every exchange. A couple of things I think he could have improved on, a couple of missed opportunities. We're going to talk about that. Today, the subject on the cross in the desert, which is something that Donald talked about a lot last night, and it was a good fiery exchange from him. We're going to take a close up front look at Hillary's disastrous foreign policy, her Middle East policy, the unbelievable things that she has said years ago in 2008 when she says, "I will attack Iran." Well, that's talking about my Iranian friends, so I want them to know the statements that she has said in regard to Iran, which I'm sure most of them are aware of. We're going to talk about Hillary's Middle East powder keg, disastrous foreign policy, and why she is certainly not qualified nor fit to be president. There are many reasons why, but today we're focusing in on the foreign policy of the Middle East. So we're going to talk about that in some depth, and I'm going to take it bit by bit. I want to expose the mess that her and Obama have created in the Middle East, and we want to talk about this. It's a very, very important topic. I want to start out the program today as I did last time, and I feel very, very confident that this is the right direction to go. Before we have interviews and guests, before we talk about the main topic, which is, of course, the election, which is only 19 days away, I want to focus in on the purpose of my program. I think that that's important to begin the day in this area. Instead of going into the political thing, I want to start out with what is the focus of my program, and that is talking about the hope and the freedom that we find in Jesus, because that's what Cross in the Desert is. It's a human rights program, to be sure. It's a human rights program for Iranians, very specifically. But I want to talk about the theme of the program today, because before we get into the political muck and muck and talk about all of the chaos and all of the debate going on in the world, I want us to focus for just a few minutes this morning on the topic and theme of the program. And today I want us to focus in on the God of irresistible love. Simply stated, we see so much hatred and violence in the world. It's all around us. We see the hatred between Trump and Clinton. We see this continual barrage of people being destroyed by hurtful words, by so much chaos and hatred. I want us to focus this morning in on the theme of the Bible, the main theme of what Scripture teaches, and that is our faithful God, who is a covenant God, a God of irresistible love. And I want us to hear very clearly this morning, before we do anything else, the heart of God for each one of us, because he truly is the God of irresistible love. A constant theme that runs throughout the pages of Scripture is the theme about God's irresistible love. The Bible portrays God as a God of immeasurable love and compassion for his children. Even when his children fall into idolatrous practices and chase after other false gods, God pursues them with his irresistible love. Though his heart is grieved, God never stops loving you and me. He never stops loving his children. Even when you and me are, they abuse the love that he freely lavishes upon them. A perfect example of this irresistible love is found in the parable that Jesus told about the prodigal son. This is his most famous parable. This is the one parable that most everyone has heard about. Jesus was a master storyteller about the love and compassion of his heavenly Father. One day, his disciples and the religious leaders gathered around him as he began to tell his most favorite and famous parable. Jesus told the story about a father who had two sons. One day, his younger son demanded the share of his inheritance. He wanted it right now. So, the father divided up his wealth between the two sons. The younger son quickly departed and left for another country, and wasted all of his inheritance on wild and promiscuous living. Desperate for money, the young son agreed to take a job feeding pigs. There was a famine at that time in the land, and the son was so hungry, tithing to him. Well, one day, the son came to his senses and decided to return home. He would beg for his father's mercy and be satisfied just to be a hired servant once again. While he was on his way home, his father saw him afar off in the distance. At that point in the parable, Jesus emphasized how the father reacted to seeing his wayward son. Instead of being angry and bitter over what his son had done, the father was instead filled with love and compassion, and he ran to his son, embracing and kissing him. The father welcomed the son in his arms of forgiveness and rejoiced that he was finally returning home. "We must celebrate with a feast," the father proclaimed, "for this son of mine was dead and now has returned to life. He was once lost, and now he is found. After listening to this powerful story of love and forgiveness, the religious leaders were appalled and offended. Their concept of God was one of anger and punishment, and certainly not grace and forgiveness. Yet this parable perfectly illustrates the God that Jesus frequently spoke about. He is a heavenly Father that never stops loving his wayward and sinning children. He is a God of irresistible love that will pursue us to the very ends of the earth and win back our hearts and affections for him. As you listen to this incredibly beautiful parable, question for you is, what is your concept of God? Are you carrying a heavy burden of guilt and shame right now? Well, Jesus spoke this parable for a person just like you. Instead of being tormented by guilt, and just like in this parable, he will run towards you and embrace you in his arms of mercy and compassion. We need to understand that our concept of God will determine our life, our future. What is your concept of God today? Do you see him as this merciful, compassionate Father that in spite of all of your wrongdoings, that he still loves you and that he embraces you? Or do you have a concept of God who is filled with rage and anger, ready to punish you for the next wrong move? It's important how you answer that question today. In conclusion, I want to feature a brand new song from Chris Tomlin. And this is a song about the compassion and love of God. He is the God of irresistible love. This is a song called God of Calvary. Let's listen.
Crazy body cross. crosses all I need to see. Oh, praise the God of Calvary.
Brand new music from Chris Tomlin. And this is an incredible song that describes the great mercy and the justice at the cross, where Jesus bore all of our shame, guilt, and God laid all of our sins upon our innocent, perfect Lamb, our innocent, perfect Savior. It is the perfect demonstration of love and of justice. And it is the only hope for our nation, for our world, is the God of Calvary. I want to thank you for listening these past 15 minutes to what I think is the most important theme of my program, The Cross in the Desert. This forever will be the theme above anything else, because it is the one good news that everyone needs to hear. It is the hope of the world, the hope of our nation. It is knowing Christ. It is following Christ. It is being filled with His mercy, His love, His compassion. His love, indeed, is the only hope for our world. Well, I want to move on now to one of the most important elections of our lifetime. I don't understand how people don't see exactly what is at stake. Our religious freedoms, our security. In many ways, this election has been called a national security election. Privately, Hillary Clinton said in a WikiLeaks email that it's really not possible to vet the Syrians. She admits privately, yet publicly, she is for mass migration of Syrians. Now, don't misunderstand me. There are many sincere Syrian people escaping the cruelty of the bombings in Aleppo and the cruelty of Assad, and we welcome these people. But the bottom line is we must properly vet every one of them very, very intensely, because if we don't, we risk another terrorist attack. And we can't afford that. And so we can show compassion, but we have to have it balanced with truth. But Hillary has made her classic case last night in the debate. And whether or not she tried to skirt out of the issue and deny it, Donald Trump brought up her bottom line motive is universal open borders. And she had some convoluted answer into his claim. But that's what the WikiLeaks mails are saying. And in speeches, she talks about universal open borders. That is an absolute recipe for disaster. Let me tell you that this election borders on the philosophy of globalism, of political correctness, globalism which is controlled by media elites and very powerful, wealthy businessmen who want to make decisions for our country in the interests of globalism. It's like a new world order, and it's that serious. If Hillary Clinton becomes president of the United States after November 8th, and she's sworn into office in January, if she becomes the leader of the free world, we will no longer have a free country. It's just that serious. It's not conspiracy. It is not fear-mongering. It is the truth. You can see how much of the media controls our thinking these days, how much of the media is in bed with Hillary. 80% of the media is on her side, and they are controlling the narrative that they want you and me to listen to. And so the media elite, with millionaires like George Soros, or billionaires I should say, are funneling money to protesters to stir up violence. They're funneling money to false accusations to bring down Trump. They are afraid of Trump because Trump is not a political insider. He's not a political correctness. He is definitely not a globalist. He is a threat to their ideology, to their worldview, to their narrative, and they will stop at nothing to expose him as something he really isn't. And so therefore, my task today is to try my best to persuade those voters that may be on the fence, that may be just debating. I want you to focus in on what a world will of Hillary Clinton be if she's president, and specifically the situation in the Middle East. I think of my dear Iranian friends when I read about Hillary signing on and agreeing with this nuclear deal. I think about their human rights and the deplorable, truly, truly deplorable situation they're in. Hillary Clinton signed on and agreed and was part of the architect for this Iranian deal. And in being the architect and being part of this deal, she completely ignores the human rights situation in Iran. My Iranian friends live in a society that controls their thinking, controls their behavior, that tells them what to believe, what not to believe. It is government control from cradle to grave, and you dare not speak out in Iran. And yet, Hillary supports a deal that funnels billions of dollars to the mullahs, billions of dollars to the terrorists, to Assad, to Hezbollah. She is the framer and architect of a plan that ignores the human rights of my dear friends in Iran. Under Rouhani, there has been almost 3,000 executions. This man is not a moderate whatsoever. There are people languishing in prison, women languishing in prison, a British Iranian citizen, Nazanin Ratcliffe, simply for visiting her parents, has been in prison in Iran since April with no hope. And now she's sentenced to 5 years, and there is no justification for her imprisonment. She is one among many that are suffering under this regime. And Hillary Clinton has said nothing about the human rights in Iran. When Obama became president and there was an outbreak of violence in the contested election of 2009, the chant in the crowd of Iranians to Obama was, "President Obama, are you with the people of Iran or with the mullahs?" And of course, he sided with the mullahs. In the same way, Hillary Clinton signs on to a deal, forges a deal with the elite that does not provide any relief for the people of Iran, and instead funnels money to a terrorist organization, the number one sponsorship of terrorism in the world. At one time in 2008, when Hillary Clinton was running against Barack Obama for president of the United States in the primaries, I want you to hear the statement that she made in regard to Iran. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
I want the Iranians to know that if I'm the president, we will attack Iran. And I want them to understand that, because it does mean that they have to look very carefully at their society, because whatever stage of development they might be in their nuclear weapons program in the next 10 years, during which they might foolishly consider launching an attack on Israel, we would be able to totally obliterate them. If I'm the president, we will attack Iran.
Those are words that my Iranian friends have never forgotten. This is a threat she made. Now, in the context, she's referring to if they strike Israel nuclearly, yeah, I will respond. But the point of the matter is she even ends her statement with, "I will obliterate Iran." Now, this is a woman who constantly claims that Donald Trump is inept, it is not qualified to be president, and that he has his hands on the nuclear codes and can't be trusted. And yet, here's a woman 8 years ago, in the same breath of anger and excitement, has her hand on Iran, and she says, "I will attack Iran. I will obliterate Iran." So how can she possibly criticize Donald Trump and the so-called nuclear codes? By the way, Hillary, I guess by a slip of the tongue, said there is 4 minutes from the time you arm these codes till there's a strike. Well, that's supposed to be secret information, but somehow in the debate last night it came out, just like the emails leaked out. Now, just this past summer, or I think it was early spring, we all heard the story of an Iranian scientist that was executed in Iran. And then we also heard the story that he was kind of a spy, a double agent, if you will. And we later learned that because of Hillary Clinton's emails from the private server that got out all over the internet and were compromised, that it's very likely that the Iranian regime read the story of this nuclear scientist and therefore were quick to arrest and execute him. So once again, Hillary not only says she will attack Iran and obliterate Iran, but because of her scandalous emails and compromise of secure classified documents, because of that, this Iranian scientist was executed. I want you to hear this special report.
Iran confirmed on Sunday the execution of a nuclear scientist who gave the U.S. intelligence about the country's contested nuclear program. This development brings back to spotlight the emails about that were on Hillary Clinton's secret server about this nuclear agreement. One America's Emily Miller has this story from Washington.
When she was Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton emailed with her aides from her private home server about a nuclear scientist who was in the United States from Iran. And now that man has been executed.
Mrs. Clinton has a demonstrated record of putting her own interests above the interests of the rule of law.
This nuclear scientist was hanged by Iran for allegedly spying for America. As Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton was directly involved in America's relationship with Sharon Amiri.
In the emails that were on Hillary Clinton's private server, there were conversations among her senior advisors about this gentleman. That goes to show just how reckless and careless her decisions was to put that kind of highly classified information on a private server.
Senator Tom Cotton's comments suggesting there's a tie, and it's gobsmacking. And Mrs. Clinton has to be held to account for putting people at risk.
Hillary's aides emailed her twice about Amiri on her private server when he was still in the United States.
And whether this man directly was executed because of what was on her emails, I don't know if you can draw that conclusion, but the fact that we're asking these questions shows you how damaging and how disruptive her email system was.
The nuclear scientist originally went missing in 2009. A year later, he turned up in America and started posting these YouTube videos saying he'd been kidnapped. But American officials said the scientist was working for them, and he was paid $5 million. Well, he left the money behind when he returned to Iran in 2010. At first, as you see here, he got a hero's welcome when he was reunited with his son in Iran. But soon after, he was arrested.
I mean, this case is as complicated as anything you'd read in a spy novel.
It may never be known who the nuclear scientist was really working for, but Clinton emailing about him from her home server is shocking to national security experts.
You know, when you leak or expose classified information, you can never be confident about what potentially you might have compromised, because you don't know what the enemy knows.
Hillary Clinton's campaign insists this is all just a conspiracy theory from the Trump campaign and insists her emails had nothing to do with the execution. However, she still has not explained why confidential emails were found on her secret home server. Emily Miller, One America News, Washington.
Unbelievable, reckless disregard for classified, very confidential information very likely cost the life of this Iranian nuclear scientist. This is unbelievable. And we hear the rhetoric last night in the debate that Donald, according to Hillary and other generals, is unfit to be president because his hands would be on the nuclear codes and he would radically make a wrong decision. How can she possibly say that when what she did with emails very likely caused the death of this nuclear scientist? And on also what she said in 2008 that she would attack Iran and obliterate them. Not only that, but Hillary has suspected, and she said there were 17 other intelligence experts that agreed with her, of course, that Russia is solely responsible for the email hacks, bringing the point that no foreign country in the history has ever been trying to persuade people of an election. So I want to bring to you this next story about Hillary and the emails and her zeal to attack Russia. Now, this is a woman that if she becomes president, you think the mess in the Middle East is bad now? Look at her record with Libya and Syria and Iran. Do you have any idea what the Middle East powder keg will be like if, God forbid, she becomes president? But I want you to hear carefully this next story, because Hillary not only it's at one time said she would attack Iran, but now she might even attack Russia. Let's listen.
If Donald Trump threatened to go to war with a major military power, do you think the media would be interested? Yet Hillary Clinton just did precisely that, and it's barely a footnote in the mainstream press. Take a look.
You've seen reports. Russia's hacked into a lot of things. China's hacked into a lot of things. Russia even hacked into the Democratic National Committee. Maybe even some state election systems. So we've got to step up our game, make sure we are well defended and able to take the fight to those who go after us. As president, I will make it clear that the United States will treat cyber attacks just like any other attack. We will be ready with serious political, economic, and military responses.
In case you missed that, Hillary just said that the next time Russia is blamed for a hack, because there's no evidence whatsoever that they were behind the DNC hack, Hillary will fight them with a military response. Fighting with a military response. That sounds a heck of a lot like a threat of war to me. Threatening to declare war on Russia. You'd think that would be a big story, right? Yet virtually no big media outlet even highlighted it. Donald Trump has been savaged for being reckless with his words. Yet here we have Hillary, openly invoking military conflict with a global superpower, and the media gives her a free pass. We've had a year of hysteria over Trump starting World War III and having control over the nuclear codes. But it's not Trump who's brazenly threatening another nuclear-armed country with war. It's Hillary Clinton. Clinton is crazy. She thinks Vladimir Putin is behind literally everything, from WikiLeaks email hacks to Trump to the rise of the alt-right, with zero evidence. But the media parrots it like it's gospel. She's also perfectly prepared to launch into wars that have disastrous consequences.
We came, we saw, he died.
And I want the Iranians to know that if I'm the president, we will attack Iran. We would be able to totally obliterate them.
Hillary Clinton openly threatening war with Russia, and the media doesn't even report on it. But they'll continue to lecture us about how it's Trump who's being irresponsible with his rhetoric. Give me a break.
I love it because it's so absolutely true. If this would have been Donald Trump publicly denouncing Russia and claiming and making an observation that they were responsible for these cyber attacks and hacked emails, and then proceeded to say if they do it again, there's going to be a response, a military response, do you have any idea how the media would have treated that statement? But, however, they're very selective. Hillary can say it, and there is no attention drawn to what she said, but they immediately race to demonize Donald Trump for the one misstep he says, for the one wrong word he uses. Notice how biased the media is. And, of course, nothing was said about this story. That's probably why you're saying, I didn't hear that, because it wasn't covered that much. Just like the James O'Keefe Project Veritas uncovering paid people within the DNC to cause riots and violence at the Donald Trump rallies, specifically in Chicago. And then they talk about voter fraud. Now, do you see any media outlet covering these secret videotapes that James O'Keefe has made? The only one I know of that's doing it is Fox News, and they're showing what's going on behind the scenes, that there are paid volunteers, if you will, you can call them that, paid people that are going out to cause violence and disrupt things at Trump rallies, and they even spoke about voter fraud. This is amazing. Now, the media won't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and Fox News will. This is something you and I need to know. This is what's going on behind the scenes of the DNC. The corruption, I believe, goes to the very top. goes right straight to the White House. Well, we can see so far that if Hillary were to become president, what the Middle East would look like, the foreign policy joke, the debacle, the powder keg would be enormous. I will attack Iran. I will attack Russia. And because of her emails, a nuclear scientist probably met his death because of them. Now, what is Hillary's attitude, you might ask, toward ISIS and toward enemies? I want you to hear a statement she made about that. Let's listen.
Showing respect even for one's enemies, trying to understand and insofar as psychologically possible, empathize with their perspective and point of view.
Showing respect for your enemies and empathizing with their point of view. Yeah, that's going to be great. As ISIS lobs off our heads and kills us, we are to respect and understand their point of view. And that's a great philosophy for the commander-in-chief, right? I'm sure you would agree with that. Well, you know, and I know, the vacuum in Iraq, when Obama in 2000 pulled out our troops and left a vacuum, which was, of course, supported by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Because of Obama and Clinton, ISIS became a reality. I want you to hear what Ben Carson has to say about this right now on the Cross in the Desert.
Showing respect even for one's enemies.
That we're seeing Mrs. Clinton hitting Donald Trump pretty hard on a number of fronts, and actually going back to an accusation that she had waged some time ago, saying that Mr. Trump is someone who is contributing to ISIS in a way that he is now a recruiter for his statements about terrorism. How do you react to that? How does the campaign react to that?
Well, I think here's a woman who has played the role of ostrich, sticking her head in the sand and not recognizing that it was the policies of Clinton Obama which created ISIS in the first place by withdrawing our forces prematurely from Iraq. Here is an individual who has jeopardized the security of our nation by putting top secret material on a private server where it could be accessed by enemies of our nation. That shows no ability whatsoever to be commander-in-chief. And, I can't even imagine why she doesn't recognize that.
And so, as you well remember, the promise that Barack Obama made about withdrawing troops and Hillary siding with him, this vacuum, and it's been well established by many military experts, this vacuum was the cause of the rise of ISIS. And we even announced that we were going to withdraw troops. Just how stupid can you be? So the policies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton led to the rise of ISIS. I want you to hear on the campaign trail what Donald Trump had to say about Hillary creating ISIS.
One thing I see out there just happened today in Tehran. They're burning down the Saudi embassy. You see that? Now, what that is Iran wants to take over Saudi Arabia. They always have. They want the oil, okay? They've always wanted that. They have a bunch of dishonest people. They've created ISIS. Hillary Clinton created ISIS with Obama. Created with Obama.
It is a fact. The reason why you have ISIS now in 32 countries of the world, policies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Just recently, I think at the Republican National Convention, Dr. Sebastian Gorka was a guest with Sean Hannity. Dr. Gorka is a best-selling author of the book Defeating Jihad. He's the chairman of the Threat Knowledge Group, where he provides training and expertise to law enforcement, military, and intelligence communities. He was also an expert on the bombing in the Boston Marathon trial. He has been on Fox News, Sky News, CNN, Breitbart. He is an expert, a great man, a great, great authority on this subject. And he had this to say about Hillary Clinton, if she became president, and her foreign policy, that it would be a disaster. Let's listen.
And welcome back to Hannity. So far at the DNC, ISIS has only been mentioned only a handful of times, and on Monday, the terror group wasn't mentioned at all. Here with reaction, author of Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, our friend Dr. Sebastian Gorka. Dr. Gorka, you know, you listen to the speakers here, Biden and Kane and of course, Obama, and you would think Hillary was the single greatest person at defeating radical Islam and, oh, that's right, they didn't mention it, most successful person in the history of being a Secretary of State. I can't think of a single accomplishment. Can you name an area of the world that she had a hand in that has gotten better?
You're asking me to defend Hillary Clinton's record? Sean, don't hold your breath on that one. Whether it's the Russian reset and then they invade Crimea, whether it's the deal with Iran that gives them $150 billion to build nuclear weapons, whether it's pulling our troops out of Iraq that facilitates the rise of ISIS, whether it's the non-red lines in Syria that led to the murder of more than 250,000 people in Syria, or whether it's taking out Gaddafi and creating a Dantean inferno in Libya that is worse than any kind of vision of hell I could come up with. It's a catastrophe wherever you look.
Let me ask you this. I don't want to mean to interrupt you. We're really short on time.
Yeah.
So does that mean we're just being propagandized? Does this that mean this is all...
Look, Sean.
What?
Sean, what has the convention been about? The only things that are bad, according to the DNC... The dangers to America are AR-15 rifles, global warming, and Donald Trump. Those are the threats to America.
Well, you got to remember, air conditioners are more dangerous or as dangerous as ISIS. And don't forget the Jobs for Jihadis program. You mention it often. But, Dr. Gorka, I'm sorry we got on a little late tonight because the president, as usual, won overtime. Thank you for being here.
Well, Dr. Gorka is really an expert, and I'm very, very happy to announce that he is going to be a guest here on The Cross in the Desert the day before the election, November 7th. That's on a Monday. You definitely want to mark your calendars because I'm going to have an opportunity to interview him and talk to him about the policies of Hillary Clinton, about his book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. Only have a few minutes to do that. He's a very, very busy man, but I am just so thrilled he'll be my guest. Now, I want to take us back to the time when Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, made a visit here to the United States. It was back in March, I think, of 2015, begging us to reject this Iran deal. The consequences of accepting this Iran deal and empowering the mullahs would be such a nuclear threat to the Middle East, especially Israel and the United States, of course. That includes us. But now I want you to also hear Hillary Clinton, what she had to say about how this deal would make Israel safer. Let's listen.
Let me just spend a minute speaking about the serious concerns that Israel's leaders have about this deal. Israel has every reason to be alarmed by a regime that both denies its existence and seeks its destruction. I would not support this agreement for one second if I thought it put Israel in greater danger. I believe in my core that Israel and America must stand side by side, and I will always stand by Israel's right to defend itself, as I always have. I believe this deal and a joint strategy for enforcing it makes Israel safer. I say that with humility. I'm not Israeli. I don't know what it's like to live under constant threat from your neighbors in a country where the margin for error is so thin. I know that my saying this deal makes you safer won't alleviate the very real fears of the Israeli people. But I have stood for Israeli security for a very long time. It was one of my bedrock principles as Secretary of State. It's why I supported stronger defense systems like the Iron Dome anti-rocket defense system, which proved so effective in protecting Israeli lives during the conflicts of 2012 and last summer. It's why I've worked closely with Israel to advance the two-state vision of a Jewish and democratic Israel with secure and recognized borders. And it's why I believe we should expedite negotiations of a long-term military assistance agreement with Israel. Let's not wait until 2017 when the current deal expires. Let's get it done this year. I would invite.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? This deal, according to Hillary Clinton, will make Israel safer. Unbelievable. Yeah, it's so convincing that Benjamin Netanyahu came to Congress in March of 2015 to speak before the Congress and urge them to do all they can to reject this bad deal. I'm sure her words rang true in his thinking when he was here in 2015. It will pave the way for a nuclear Iran in the next several years. There is no accountability to what they will do with this deal. It has strengthened them economically with the billions of dollars funneled toward the terrorist regime. Even Kerry says he can't predict that they won't use this money for the wrong reasons. Give me a break. This will make Israel safer. It will put them, the Middle East, and the world in jeopardy. And yet, it was signed by law in July of 2015. As I sit here, I think of my Iranian friends. I think of the terror that they suffer every day. I think of what Hillary says, that it will make Israel safer. Did her compromised emails make the life of the nuclear scientist of Iran safer? No, he was executed. Mismanagement is not even the right word. Careless recklessness is not even the right word. It is treasonous to do what she did. And as Donald Trump says, I am shocked with everything that she has done, breaking the law, that she has been allowed to run for president. That was his words last night in the debate, and I completely agree with him. Now, besides the foreign policy we've been talking about here, the disaster it would be for the world, and some of the statements that Hillary Clinton has made that have already proved to be disastrous, we've talked about, the most serious one of them all is her relentless pursuit of increasing the number of Syrian refugees into our country. Remember the universal open borders. And remember what the WikiLeaks says in private. Hillary admits that Syrians cannot be successfully all vetted. She says that in private. I want you to hear once again my good friend, Dr. Sebastian Gorka, on Fox News talking about this disastrous refugee plan that Hillary, if she became president, would become a reality. Let's listen.
Hillary Clinton admits in a private speech refugees can't possibly be vetted. This is a reference to Jordan's Syrian refugee crisis. Here, let me give you the exact quote. They have hundreds of thousands of refugees and they can't possibly vet all those refugees. So they don't know if, you know, jihadis are coming in along with legitimate refugees. Sebastian Gorka is with us, author of Defeating Jihad and a frequent guest on this program. What is going on here? You say one thing in private and your policy in public is totally different.
It's quite stunning, Stuart. We now have confirmation of what everybody knew, that the political elite says one thing for our consumption and the exact opposite behind closed doors. And the list is incredible. In front of Deutsche Bank, she said that fracking is good. In public, she says fracking is bad. During the debate, she's in favor of no-fly zones in Syria. Behind closed doors to Goldman Sachs, she says no, no-fly zones don't work. So the fact that she wants to increase by 500% the refugee flow into America, when she says behind closed doors that these people cannot be vetted to separate jihadis from true refugees, tells you everything you need to know about the threat to American security, Stuart.
She will change America forever without telling us what she's about to do. That's my opinion. Okay, I've got to bring this one to our attention. And before we roll this videotape, I want to warn all of our viewers, this is truly graphic video, and it's about to go on your screen. I don't like this stuff, believe me, but I want to show it for impact.
This is a young Syrian child blooded and crying for her father inside a hospital after her town was bombed. Right. It's, the video is actually a good deal worse than that, so let's not see it. Sebastian, that's another example of a chilling image from the catastrophe in Syria. I want to know, who's to blame for Aleppo?
Well, we should be the nation that leads others to stop humanitarian tragedies like this. This isn't about some kind of neoconservative conspiracy to invade other countries and turn them into mirror images of America. It's about stopping these horrific, almost genocidal attacks. And when you have a president, a White House, and a Secretary Clinton who say we are going to lead from behind, this is what you get. When you have a White House that says we're going to draw a line in the sand, we're going to have red line after red line, and when those lines are crossed by the Assad regime, America does nothing, this is the type of picture, this is the footage that we will see as a result. And remember, this is just one child out of millions.
Yeah, I remember the little boy in Aleppo that made headlines worldwide. Sebastian, thank you very much for joining us again. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart.
All right.
Stuart Varney interviewing Dr. Sebastian Gorka. And as always, he is very expertise, very knowledgeable, very articulate about what's going on. And they talked about the fact that Hillary Clinton admitted privately there's no way to vet all of these Syrian refugees, yet publicly she's all for it. It is a disaster. It is a chaotic situation if she were to have anything to do as president with the Middle East. I can't begin to imagine the suffering children in Syria. Breaks my heart. And yet it could have been avoided if certain policies had been implemented from the very beginning. And so we see the terrors of the Middle East. We know what's going on with Hillary Clinton at the helm. But I want to conclude now with what I think, for me personally, is really the number one issue that I want to end this segment on. And that is the issue of women's rights. I started off by saying that Hillary approved of a deal that was supposed to curb the Iran nuclear program. And in joining with that deal, she completely ignored, as well as President Obama, completely ignored the suffering human rights, egregious human rights violations in Iran. Nothing has ever been said about these people that suffer every day. And in particular, Hillary Clinton at the Beijing conference in 1993 said, women's rights are human rights, and yet she takes money and accepts donations from Saudi Arabia, other Middle Eastern countries. She accepts it. The Clinton Foundation accepts these donations and are silent about the rights of women that are suffering in these countries, about the murder of gays, the imprisonment of women. I could write another book and document the number of people suffering and crying in Iranian prisons, the number of people that have gone to the hangman's noose with no one to be their voice. And here is a woman that said in 1993 in the Beijing conference that women's rights are human rights. And where is her voice for these suffering women, victims of acid attacks, victims of honor killings, those that are being imprisoned and tortured in Iran? Where is her voice? It is nowhere. Because the Clinton Foundation, which of course abandoned the people of Haiti at a crisis when they had an earthquake and promised them all this money. By the way, she made a misstatement last night that Donald Trump should have called her on. That 90% of the donations to the Clinton Foundation goes to the people. It is an absolute lie. Barely enough goes to them, maybe 6%, but not 90%. The Clinton Foundation is a money laundering scheme, and she has been bought and paid for and silent about women's rights. What I want you to do now is hear this absolutely brilliant package put together by Sean Hannity, along with Sebastian Gorka, on the hypocrisy of Hillary Clinton and women's rights. Let's listen.
She has taken through the Clinton Foundation and donations to the Clinton Library. I want to go through this slowly. Stay with me. Mm-hmm. If you start with Saudi Arabia, okay, $25 million up to that amount to the Clinton Foundation, $10 million to the Clinton Library. Women can't drive. They need permission to work or travel. Marital rape not recognized. If you're gay or lesbian, punishable by death. No churches, no temples in Saudi Arabia. She takes their money. Go to Kuwait, up to $10 million donated to the Clinton Foundation. Courts deny women the right to become public prosecutors and judges. No laws against domestic violence or rape. And if you're gay and you're involved in a homosexual act, well, that's illegal and you can get 7 years in prison and a fine. If you go to the UAE, they donated up to $5 million to the Clinton Foundation. Men have the legal right to beat their wives with physical violence. Marital rape is not recognized. Same-sex marriage is illegal. All sex activity outside of marriage is illegal, and women are often punished severely for adultery. Then we go to Brunei. Money donated to the Clinton Foundation, up to $5 million. Marital rape is not a crime, as the wife is not under the age of 13. And if you're gay, those acts are illegal, punishable by up to 10 years in prison, in some cases death. Qatar. $5 million up to that amount to the Clinton Foundation. Marital rape, not a crime. The law states that it's a woman's responsibility to obey her husband. And if you're gay and you commit gay acts, punishable by death. Oman, up to $5 million to the Clinton Foundation. A woman's consent is not required to legalize a marriage. Marital rape is not a crime. If you're gay, it's punishable by up to 6 months to 3 years in prison. Algeria gave, what, up to $500,000 to the Clinton Foundation. Marital rape, not a crime. Married women under 18, they can't travel abroad without the permission of their husband. Homosexual activity is illegal, punishable by 2 months to 2 years in prison and a fine. And the Washington Post reports that many Middle Eastern countries donated over $1 million to the Clinton Foundation, as you can see up there on the screen. Now, I say all of this. She says she's the champion of women's rights and gay rights. And up until this week, she's never criticized the practices of these countries and took their money. How corrupt, you know, is that hypocrisy in your view?
Sean, I have to commend you and your amazing team. You have just summarized with some very important data and research everything that the Huffington Post and the New York Times should be doing. If they actually believed in the values that they spout, they should have published what you just summarized in 3 minutes, and Hillary Clinton's campaign would be down in flames. She would be exposed for what she is, a person who loves power more than anything else and is prepared to say one thing while receiving money from the people who stand for exactly the opposite.
So seriously, if all the reports that we read, all right, that Donald Trump has trouble with the women's vote. Mitt Romney was excoriated because he had women's resumes and binders, women that he wanted to hire. Women are treated, discriminated against in all of these countries she took money against. Gays and lesbians are either executed or punished severely. They're mistreated. She claims to be their champion. If you're a Christian, you cannot build a temple. A church in Saudi Arabia. You cannot build a temple if you're Jewish. She claims to be the advocate, the champion of all of their rights. How do you explain the taking of money in this particular case?
Very simply, for the left today, not the Democrat Party of the 1960s of JFK, but for the Democrat Party today, reality is optional. It has been kidnapped by the Alinskyites. For them, it is just the cause. You say whatever you like as long as you can maintain power. It's not about truth, Sean, anymore. It's about staying in power and getting the millions. You've just proven it.
Dr. Sebastian Gorka, author of the best-selling book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, on with Sean Hannity, exposing the hypocrisy of Hillary Clinton, who claims to be the champion of women's rights. And I want you to know, since we're talking about women's rights, there was the subject of abortion last night. And Hillary Clinton pointed out that, you know, some women are in very desperate situations that right at the very last term of their pregnancy have to have a child aborted because of some kind of disease, maybe Down syndrome, that will be heaped upon them. It will be suffering. They have to make these groundbreaking decisions, these life and death decisions. And she was saying, I need to protect the rights of women and the health of women. And Donald Trump bombastically came right back at her and says, I do not believe in a child being ripped from the mother's womb just a few days before being born. And he made that point because, and I was saying this to my wife, Becky, do these women really find out a month or so before the birth of the child that this is going to be a child riddled with disease or something? And, of course, the answer is no. They would find out much earlier on. She's trying to make a case, listen carefully, that a woman can be given the right to terminate the pregnancy of a child even a day before it's born. I could not believe the radical viewpoint that Hillary Clinton has, and yet she is a champion for the rights of women to kill, listen carefully, to kill their own children. The more I think about it, the more enraged I get to think that this radical feminist would be in favor of a law to give the right to women to terminate their pregnancy just maybe a few days before giving birth. We have to stop this kind of genocide. We have to speak out, and we have to preserve life. The left does not preserve life. They're in favor of destroying life under the banner of women's rights. And yet, as Donald Trump aptly pointed out, he would never be in favor for that. He used the word ripped. It is unimaginable the suffering and the pain these innocent children endure because of a so-called right of a woman. It's unimaginable. What I want to do now, I want to move on, but before I do that, as we've taken step by step and analyzed the policies of Hillary Clinton, especially today, we've talked about the Middle East, Iran, Russia, ISIS, we've talked about the Syrian refugees, we've talked about the so-called champion of women's rights, that she's not really the champion of women's rights. I want to urge you to analyze and think very carefully, especially if you're one that's undecided and sitting on the fence. This election is about national security and life, precious life, the precious life of unborn children, our national security against terrorist attacks, our being represented by a conservative Supreme Court. This election is absolutely monumental. If you decide not to vote, it's a vote for Hillary, And of course, this is your choice. You have that right. But after everything that has been said, if you choose to vote for Hillary instead, think about the ramifications and the power of your vote. Do you really want to see the kind of future that lies ahead with a vote for Hillary? Now, both candidates are flawed. They both have character problems. But I think you can see, if you balance out and compare the two, that Hillary is extremely corrupt and dangerous compared to a Donald Trump who cares about our national security, who cares about our veterans, who cares about our military, who cares very deeply about our economy and jobs. I don't think it's that hard to make a decision. But I hope and pray that after today, I have said something that will stimulate your thinking in the right direction about the most important election, really, of our lifetime as we think about the future of America. What I want to do now is I want to play a song for you by a very fine and talented Christian band. They're a conservative Christian band from Australia. Their name is Of King and Country. And we're going to hear from them about a movie that they recently produced and is now out and showing in the theaters across the nation, and it's called Priceless. I want you to hear this beautiful tribute to how to treat women with respect, that they are priceless. And I want you to hear this song right now, On the Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
Australia's answer to Coldplay. The Grammy-winning duo for King and Country have already made a name for themselves in the world of music. And now, brothers Joel and Luke Smallbone have a new book out and a movie that opens in theaters October the 14th. The title is Priceless, and it stars Joel Smallbone. Take a look.
We're all on a journey, but it seems somewhere along the way I took a wrong turn. And then it happened. Never even saw it coming. Did I fail?
Let's go!
Did I do what needed to be done?
Hey, the girls, where are you taking?
Not your problem.
If you're hearing a little voice that's telling you to stay, you might want to listen to that voice.
I want to shut this thing down. I see you
dressed in white. How could you just leave us?
You have to trust me.
That word is broken for you.
I'm going to make this right.
Well, please welcome back to the 700 Club for King and Country, Joel and Luke Smallbone. It's good to have you here with
us
again.
It's good to see you again.
Third time. Yeah,
that's right.
Third time is the charm.
It's
the
shouting, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Third time, three projects, right?
Exactly.
Let's talk about some of that. First of all, for people, I can't imagine who they might be, but who haven't heard your music or known of you at all, you come from a musical family. I mean, this isn't like you just decided one day, hey, let's start a band or something. I mean, you really grew up with this.
I was actually talking earlier to some of the folks behind the scenes. I said, I was here with my sister, who goes by the name Rebecca St. James, 5 years ago. And so I was just there actually kind of helping road managing her. And we came, and that's where we kind of built some of the friendships behind the scenes. So to be able to come back and be with you guys, but also to have that musical heritage is part of the reason why. And the way that we've been able to learn so many different things is because of the way we were raised.
And not just the musical heritage, but working behind the scenes for and with Rebecca really kind of taught you how this whole thing works. How did you get into doing it yourself?
Well, we joked that our dad, who managed Rebecca, manages us, he needed cheap labor. And he has five sons. And so he looked around and he thought, well, okay, well, we'll put them all to work as the road crew. And, you know, Luke did a lot of lighting. We did background vocals. And that was really, well, there's two things, Terry. We got to see, just engineering-wise, how a show is put on and how you construct a stage and lighting and all the rest of it. But probably most importantly, the impact of music. That it has a way of bypassing the head and going straight to the heart. And that's what we hope with the film and the book as well.
And speaking of impact, working with Rebecca also gave you an insight into women. And I want you to talk about that because, you know, a lot of guys your age wouldn't be in touch with that. But what did you see when you were working with her that really stirred you and brought you to this place?
Well, she had always had a major message to young ladies about chastity, young women and young men. And as Luke and I began, it was actually a very interesting moment in time because he had just gotten married and I met my now wife, Mariah, at his wedding. Ah. She was kind of a wedding crasher. She was, yes, it was.
I orchestrated it perfectly.
He orchestrated the whole thing.
And so right simultaneously to all of that happening, we started traveling as a band for King Country. And so we had this simple message. We'd stand on a stage and we'd say, hey, ladies, know that you deserve to be treated with the utmost respect and honor, and that to us men, but it's time for us to step up and stand up, that chivalry is alive and well. And it's been alarming and exciting to see the response. Yeah. Exciting because people have responded. Alarming because it's like folks are starving to hear this message.
So that is the message in Priceless. Yeah. Where did that concept come from? I mean, here you are, successful as musicians and vocalists, but then a book and the movie, which came first?
You think we're crazy, don't you?
Just a little, but crazy's good.
Well, the movement started first, and then we started to realize that there's kind of an epidemic going on here, and people are really gravitating to that message. And so our older brother Ben is a film director, and we went to him and we said, hey, what do you think about this whole concept? And we build a movie around it.
I don't think we knew what we were asking.
No, we were reckless and silly young men. And that's how you get into the film world, I guess, because it's complicated. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. But yet we felt like we had to share this message. And I'm so thankful that we're at this point now where the film's coming out in just a few weeks, because it's been a lot of work, but it's been super thrilling. And even just doing the showings and the viewings of the film, the responses that we're getting, it's like, oh, this is why we did all that work.
It feels like the culmination in some ways of the Priceless movement, you know, where that it's illustrated in this book and in this film.
And the film really deals with trafficking, which is such an issue and a topic today, and not one that is just being surfacely looked at. I mean, I think people are recognizing that this is a huge problem, and not just in other parts of the world, but here in the United States as well.
Yeah, one of the things we asked ourselves with the Priceless movement inherently is, what's the antithesis of this? And it's that a life or that a woman can be bought, the pleasure can be bought. And so there is that real moment in the middle of the film that drops into this world. And what we hoped that there's two things in the film. It's a gritty drama, thriller, love story for sure, as you saw in the trailer. But we hope that people walk away with two questions. One, internally, what's my responsibility as a man in this modern era to love well? Who am I as a woman under God, and who have I been designed to be? And then secondly, what's my global responsibility?
Yeah.
And start a conversation.
We all have a responsibility. Yes, I mean, it's not enough just to say bad thing, bad thing. I mean, we need to be doing something about it. You're acting. So can we add that to the list of what was that like?
I said we're pretty silly. Yeah. We're not very bright. You know.
Luke wanted to be involved, but we always did these short films growing up as a family, and for whatever reason, Luke was always the first one to get killed off in the short film. So he was like, I'm not doing it. I'm out. It was beautiful. I was very fortunate to play one of the lead characters, James Stevens, a very polarizing man to myself. And he just has this sort of tragic story. And what's beautiful about this sub-story, Terry, is he, in a lot of ways, is really fighting for these young ladies to save them physically. But on the other hand, this young lady, particularly Antonia, she is really, her resolve and strength as a woman is saving him kind of mentally and spiritually. It's a beautiful sub-story.
And it's released on the...
October 14th.
October 14th.
Yeah, yeah. Nationwide
in theaters. In theaters. So sounds wonderful. And, of course, book by the same name. Yeah. I always like to read the book first and
exactly.
then see the film.
You and me.
You're on it.
Like mine.
You've got a book right there, Terry, so you can read that
yes,
one. There you
yes.
go. Take that home with you.
Well, we all want to hear you sing today because, you know, you have history of that here with us. So I'm going to release you all and let you go over to the music set. Great to have you here again.
Well, it is a very successful movie, and the message of saving victims of human trafficking is worth just going to see the movie about. The attention that it brings to this issue of the sexual exploitation of women and children in the human trafficking movement is so well needed. It's not just a problem in the Middle East or in Europe or other places. It's really a problem here. And the wealth, the worth and the value of a woman is upheld in this movie. A very, very important film and a book to read. And, of course, of King and Country, they're a great band. And musically, they are wonderful. And this film is really the result of a movement they began called the Priceless Movement. Think of the word priceless and think of the value and worth of human life. And the God of the Bible says in Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 3, I have loved you with an everlasting love. This is the message I began the program with today, the God of irresistible love. Elsewhere, in Isaiah chapter 49, verse 15, the question is asked, can a woman forget her nursing child, that she would have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you. Behold, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. Did you hear that incredible statement of God's commitment and love? Even if a nursing mother forsook you, I will not forget you, God says. And then he says the prophetic, beautiful statement, behold, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. Where do we see the ultimate engraving take place? On the palms of God's hands. We see that at the cross, where he stretched out his arms of love for you and me, endured a horrible death to cleanse you and me of all of our guilt and shame. And he can say here in Isaiah, 1,000 years or more before that beautiful act, he can say, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. As we watch our world in turmoil and the uncertainty of our future, and we see the violence and the death, the hatred and the bloodshed, we are reminded today the words of our Lord and God, I have loved you with an everlasting love. And don't fear, no matter if you're even forsaken by your own mother, I will not forgive you. I will not forsake you. I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. This is an act of absolute perfect love that God demonstrated when Jesus died on the cross. He had our names engraved on the palms of your hand, of his hands. If you have come to faith in Christ, you know that your name was on his heart and on his hand more than 2,000 years ago. What does that mean in a world of chaos, in a world of fear and hatred? What that means is that there is a God of absolute, perfect, and irresistible love that will never forsake you. He is a God that loves you unconditionally with an everlasting love, he says. An everlasting love. And that to remind you that he's not forsaken you, he has promised that your name is engraved on the palm of his hands, that you belong to him as his covenant child, that he will never walk away from that love for any reason, because you belong to him. And in this world where there is so much uncertainty and so much violence and hatred, God is reminding us that he has engraved our very names, palms of his hand. I love the statements of God's perfect love. When you read the Bible, you are reminded each and every day of his love for you. Psalm 103 is just another example of what we're saying today. Let's go to Psalm 103 and let's listen to the words of David in praise of God, who reminds us of God's character and nature. Listen to him. He says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquity and heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, and satisfies you with good. The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. As a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear him." Compassion, mercy, everlasting love. This is who our He is our holy God. He is our sovereign God. But his anger does not last forever. Even though he's holy and sovereign, he abounds in loving kindness and mercy. You see, you can't appreciate all of what I've said until you recognize that mercy and compassion is something we did not deserve. You can only appreciate what I'm saying when you recognize that you and I were guilty of heinous sin, and we deserved the judgment of God. We deserved his wrath. But God chose not to demonstrate his wrath toward us, demonstrate his grace and forgiveness and mercy in Jesus. And then when we recognize that we deserved it, we deserved God's judgment because of our sin, when we recognize that, then we begin to grasp the beautiful reality of grace, the beautiful reality of love that is unconditional. And I hope that this message and what I've read in God's Word today, what I began this program today, if anything I want you to remember, that would be the most important thing to remember. Because this is what will keep us alive. This is the hope that we need. This is the security that we're holding on to. In our world of hatred and violence and uncertainty, the anchor of God's irresistible love, his mercy and compassion, is an anchor that we must never, never forget. I like to say it this way. We're not so much holding on to God. He is holding on to us. He keeps us safe in his arms of love. And so today on the program, We've learned about the plot against our government, the plot of the media, and the evil schemes of corrupt politicians. And we should be warned about it so that we can vote intelligently and we can make our voice be heard on November 8th. But I want to remind you, in spite of all of these important things, that the most important thing I want to communicate to you today is that absolute certainty and unwavering love and compassion of our great God and Savior. I don't know what your situation is today. I don't know what your fears are today, but this message of His irresistible love is a message that you and I need to hear every single day when we look at the world around us and we see the corruption and we see the evil and we see the chaos. I want to thank you so much for joining me today, taking time out of your busy schedule and joining me today on the Cross in the Desert. I want to thank Vito for being my guest in the chat room. It's always so good to visit with Vito from the Radio Jihad Network. I want to say God bless you and join me next Tuesday for a very special tribute to Rahana Jabari. God bless you. I will see you on the next Cross in the Desert. Have a great weekend.
My night.